This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I don't know that we've ever had a weekend with more powerful stories than we published over the past weekend. This is going to be a special episode of Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn here with Lisa Garvin, Laura Johnston, and Layla Tassi. I don't think we're going to fit it all in, but let's try. Why is Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost arguing to keep abortion restriction laws in place in spite of the overwhelming passage last year of an amendment to the Ohio Constitution to enshrine abortion as a right? Laura?
Because he says they were allowed under Roe versus Wade, and that's what Ohio voters thought they were returning to when they overwhelmingly approved the constitutional amendment in November. We're talking about a number of rules passed over the years that kind of whittled down the rights of abortion in Ohio, forcing a pregnant woman to wait 24 hours between her initial doctor's appointment and the abortion, laws requiring women to sign various legal documents about the risks of abortion, and promises that they're not having the procedure under duress or intoxication, laws to attest they were given the opportunity to listen to the embryonic heartbeat, and of course, the really big one, the 2019 heartbeat law, which is on hold because of another lawsuit. So remember that what we passed in November was very short, basically, compared to a lot of laws. It generally guarantees the right of abortion until fetal viability around 22 to 24 weeks, except for in extreme cases. But Yost is putting this in a brief in the Franklin County Court, where five abortion clinics and a doctor who works for the Women's Med Center in Dayton filed the suit on March 29th. We were waiting to see what happened. We passed this law. What was going to come next? Are we, you know, was it going to take a case to challenge all these laws? Well, that's what those five groups and that doctor did, was just say, hey, let's challenge this. And Yost is arguing that Judge David Young should not put the laws on hold while their overall constitutionality is weighed in this trial, because he says people thought we were going back to status quo and these laws were part of status quo.
Yeah, that's the fallacy of what he's saying. Nobody said, let's put it back to Roe v. Wade. What they passed was an amendment that said abortion is a right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for over the last 10, 20 years, lawmakers have tried to carefully restrict the Roe v. Wade ruling. They've put limit after limit after mm-hmm. limit on abortion. When Roe v. Wade got tossed in the Dobbs decision, people went nuts and were like, no, you're not going to do this. And they reset the clock. If you want to reset the clock to Roe v. Wade, fine. But all of these laws since then have whittled it away, and nobody agreed to that. That was forced on the population by lawmakers who are operating outside of what the voters wanted. I'm not surprised Yost is doing this, right? He wants to be governor, and he's got to run in a Republican primary against John Houston and whoever else might raise their hand. So he has to appeal to the far right, even if that means putting in nonsense. Like, the voters went for Roe v. Wade. Nowhere is that said. That's not right. What the constitutional amendment says, and that's a bogus argument. Here's the problem he faces. The Supreme Court of Ohio has to run for re-election. Abortion is the most powerful issue facing voters. It's the thing that moves voters to passion. So if he gets this before the Supreme Court, which is usually knee-jerk to those far-right conservative causes, it's dangerous for him, because then it'll turn abortion into the issue for their re-election runs. I don't think they want that. So I think there's a good chance they're going to say, Dave Yost, you're full of it. This was never about Roe v. Wade. This was about enshrining a right to abortion. A right is a right. You can't whittle it away with these nonsense laws.
Well, and that's the whole idea, right? Because that was never part of the constitutional amendment. That was very clear. But he's saying it's about what people believe and how people were interpreting constitutional amendment, their understanding of the amendment. But you're right. I this would be controversial if it gets to the Supreme Court. Right now, he's going against this Franklin judge, who is a Democrat, by the way. He's also arguing they don't have standing to bring this right to sue because they're not people, that the preterm Cleveland, Northeast Ohio Women's Center, and those kind of groups are not people and don't have standing on this law, which is ridiculous. They're voicing all of for the voiceless, all the women who need their services.
Don't you love it when the male Ohio Attorney General mansplains what's in women's heads when it comes to abortion?
Don't get me started on
that. It's so presumptuous that he's telling us what we were thinking when we went to the polls. I mean, the Republicans completely blew what people were thinking about this issue. That's
and they've admitted that. That was what we talked about last week.
Yeah. So it's I get why he's doing it, but this could blow up in his face. This could turn abortion into a general election thing for him, which would not play well. He's trying to win the primary, but then he has to run in the general if he wins. You're listening to Today in Ohio. The Biden administration wants to reclassify marijuana to make crimes involving it lesser than they are now, but recreational use would still be against federal law. We asked Ohio congressional leaders what they think of the administration's failure to follow the clear will of the American people and legalize it once and for all. Lisa, what did they tell us?
Yeah, there's a Drug Enforcement Administration proposal that wants to reclassify marijuana from a Schedule 1 substance, which is the strictest, to Schedule 3, which is in the same league as steroids, testosterone, and Tylenol with codeine. They found that marijuana has a moderate to low potential for physical or psychological dependence, but so many lawmakers say it just doesn't go far enough. So in the Senate, there are 18 Democratic senators that reintroduced the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act, which would remove weed entirely from the federal controlled substance list and then have the FDA establish product standards and the U.S. Department of Transportation set standards for cannabis impaired driving. So Dave Joyce, our congressman, the Republican from South Russell, is head of the House Cannabis Caucus. He agrees. He says this doesn't go far enough. He says additional federal reforms are needed to avoid contradicting the will of the states that have legalized marijuana and also get a public safety focused regulatory model for marijuana. So they've introduced what's called the States Act, strengthening the 10th Amendment through entrusting states, that would remove marijuana from the list if it's grown, distributed, and delivered in compliance with state and tribal laws, and would also provide federal law enforcement support for states that decide to ban marijuana completely. The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML, Deputy Director Paul Armentano says the DEA announcement is in line with the Health and Human Services recommendations that marijuana does have medicinal value and it has a superior safety profile to drugs and substances that are unscheduled. That would be lower than Schedule 3. He says, my hope this will change the way we talk and think about cannabis and how we legislate it in the future.
What is stupid about this, though, is if you're going to change it, why not just follow the will of the states? I mean, voters are going to the polls. Whether you agree with it or not, the voters are saying, no, make it legal. And for the feds to have this disconnect where even though your state has said you are free to use it as you please, you're still violating a federal statute. If you care about following the law, you're in violation. I don't get why you'd make a halfway change. Either change it and get rid of it and leave it to the states, which the states have clearly stated they want, or don't change it because it's a hollow gesture.
Well, there's a group that's opposed to this, you know, changing, reclassifying marijuana. They're called Smart Approaches to Marijuana. They say it's a political move in an election year to reverse polling trends, especially with young people, and that this would have a predetermined outcome. So they said a drug isn't medicine because it's popular.
Yeah, but but that train has left the station. The state after state after state, including Ohio, people have voted in mass to say, we think this is an herb. We don't see it as an illegal drug anymore. It ought to be legal. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Okay, Layla, let's get to these stories I opened the podcast episode with. Reporter Jake Zuckerman had a shocker of a story over the weekend about how fracking chemicals from a site owned by a state senator migrated far, resulting in an expensive cleanup. But someone other than the state senator is getting billed for that cleanup. This seems scandalous. What's the explanation?
State Senator Brian Chavez owns the site in Noble County, which leaked fracking waste deep underground before it blasted through the surface miles away at an oil well back in 2021, and it cost the state $1.3 million to clean it up. But Jake tells us that Chavez or his company Deep Rock Disposal Solutions has never reimbursed the state for dealing with that mess, nor did the state even ask. Instead, state regulators billed the owners of that idled production well where the brine spewed out before it went on to contaminate nearby land and water. Chavez owns several oil and gas companies and reported investments in several others. In June of 2021, DeWine appointed Chavez to serve on the Oil and Gas Commission. That's a panel of five commissioners that considers appeals of ODNR's orders against the industry. Chavez represented major petroleum until he was appointed to the Senate this past December. In January of 2021, while Chavez was sitting on that commission, state records show that Deep Rock Disposal Solutions acquired two wells housing brine at high pressure, thousands of feet underground. At that point, their brine already had reached at least three production wells over the prior decade. Just weeks later, a production well owned by West Virginia-based Genesis Resources began spitting out this brine at rates reaching 42 gallons per minute. And it took ODNR officials and contractors days to plug this leak. Records show that they removed more than 362,000 gallons of liquid from a nearby stream, and a whole bunch of wildlife died. The Genesis well hadn't been producing oil in years, so this clearly was not a Genesis problem. This was a Deep Rock problem, and it was only one of five incidents of Deep Rock's brine discharging from nearby production wells between 2010 and 2023. 2 years after that big blowout at the Genesis well, EPA officials determined that another production well a few miles away was releasing brine into a stream, and finally ODNR suspended Deep Rock's operations and called them out for these spillages. But the state billed Genesis for this cleanup, $1.3 million. Genesis disputes that the obvious argument that Deep Rock caused the problem, but the state said it doesn't matter. The brine couldn't have found the surface without Genesis's abandoned well.
That's just a shocker to me. That makes no sense. I mean, long ago, people drilled for oil and gas the normal way, not the fracking way. They go down, they pull it out of the earth, they finish, they go away. This other company fills the earth with this poison, which becomes radioactive as it interacts with things that are deep in the earth, and it shoots up through these holes. Of course it's going to, and yet it's the person that drilled the hole in the first place that gets blamed. This is crooked. Why would Mike DeWine's appointments, one after another, have turned out to be terrible? Why is this guy? Why was he on the Oil and Gas Commission before he became a senator? It seems like he's not the kind of guy you want on there. He's part of the problem. The other thing is, this is the second time in a week we're talking about this pressurized fracking fluid migrating and popping back up. Isn't this a sign that maybe we should stop putting poison in the earth under pressure because this is what happens to it?
Yeah, you'd think so. You would. I mean, I loved how Jake walked off of his story with those climate change denials from this guy. I just can't believe how all in we are on this terrible technology, and it's so harmful to the environment.
Well, and he was on the Oil and Gas Commission making money off of it. How is that appropriate? Do you really think we're going to get fair and unbiased rulings?
Of course not.
This is the commission that stepped in on last week's story to overrule the state regulators that were trying to close a leaky fracking operation, and they overruled it and kept it running for six more months. They only shut it down when they realized Jake had a story coming out that was going to paint the whole picture. They shut it down 2 days before publication of the story.
Well, and this guy was on the commission as this problem was unfolding.
Yeah,
he was sitting on the commission at that moment.
I don't know what is going on with Mike DeWine, but every time we talk about Mike DeWine and the oil and gas industry, he's on the wrong side of it. He was on the wrong side of it when he put Randazzo on the PUCO. He's on the wrong side of it with these appointments. We need people who are going to look out for the environment here, not industry inside. This was the cleanup cost, what, $1.8 million? Is that what you said it was?
$1.3 million.
This guy's escaping paying. Why? Is it because he has political connections? Great story by Jake. You're listening to Today in Ohio.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Courtney Astolfi also had a great story. We talked recently about the hiring of Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibbs' college roommate into a key public safety position in the city, despite his involvement in an ugly civil rights case as a Washington, D.C. cop. We thought the story was over, but then he came over and told us his version of what happened in the civil rights case. This is now a big story again because the record doesn't match what he told us. What are the big lies, Layla?
Yeah, it seems that Philip McHugh has told some lies regarding his involvement in that DC case. The question is, did he lie to the editorial board when he told us his story, or did he lie under oath when he was deposed in this case? He claims he didn't lie at all, that both stories are true.
Which is obviously impossible. That's impossible, as we will show. He is doing the Trump doublespeak where you are just going to pretend we don't live in a universe of facts and straight information. To say both stories can be true, no, they can't. He lied.
Right. So the case underlying this happened in 2015 when McHugh was a fledgling detective with the Washington, D.C. Police Department. A motorist had told McHugh and another officer that she had an argument with an elderly couple in their 70s after a fender bender. Vashti and Eugene Sherrod were their names. And the motorist said that Vashti Sherrod had pointed a gun at her during the argument. There was grainy surveillance of evidence of this altercation, but it was impossible to tell if Vashti was actually holding a gun or a magazine or something else like that, you know, like a piece of paper. McHugh also found no evidence that the Sherrods even owned a gun, yet he had their home searched, didn't turn up any evidence of a gun. He later had their vehicle stopped and searched, and he even obtained an arrest warrant for Vashti Sherrod. All of these aggressive tactics led to the Sherrods filing this civil rights lawsuit against the police and McHugh, which eventually ended in a settlement for the Sherrods. McHugh, as everyone knows, this year was hired by the administration of his old roommate, Justin Bibb, for a job that pays him $124,000. And this civil rights case came screaming back at him. McHugh went on a tour of sorts recently to kind of explain away his involvement. He talked to a big group of pastors, some city council members, city workers, and he came to talk to our editorial board. And the story he told us was that he never wanted to pursue the case against the Sherrods. He said he's very sorry about what happened to them, but actually he was just doing what the prosecutors told him to do. He said he asked them to drop the case, but they said they insisted they wanted to pursue it. They kept sending him out to raid their home and arrest them and search for the gun. And he said, these are his words to us, look, he said, I said to the prosecutors, look, I've done everything you've told me to do. I have searched their car and searched their house. I checked with the ATF and checked with the state police. They have no record of her ever having a gun. We have no evidence beyond the victim's statement and the surveillance video. Please just deny my warrant. And they said, no, we're going to charge her. Anyway, he was very contrite about the role he played in this case to us, but he says it wasn't his fault. He pointed us to the case file. For the civil rights case, he said, read the file and you'll see what I'm talking about. Well, Courtney had already read a great deal of the file, but she accepted this challenge and read the whole thing. And she found the most important document of all to getting to the bottom of this, McHugh's sworn deposition. And wouldn't you know it, what he told the editorial board doesn't match up to the account in his deposition at all. There he couldn't be more clear that he was the driving force behind this investigation, and that the prosecutor simply concurred with his conclusions. Not once in that 75-page transcript does McHugh say he asked prosecutors to end his investigation or asked them to deny charges. Instead, he described how he and prosecutors agreed on how to proceed at different times throughout the probe. The prosecutors concurred with him on next steps, and he said on the decision to arrest Vashti, he said, we collaboratively agreed that we were at a point for a warrant to be signed. And here's his most damning quote. He said, they agreed with me that it showed Ms. Sherrod pointing a gun at the accuser. This is the video he's talking about. And that's when we made the decision that we would go forward with trying to find the car, trying to search the car, and consider doing a search warrant at the house. I believe the accuser. I believe the video corroborates her series of events. So did my supervisors. So did the U.S. Attorney's office.
That is why these two statements cannot both be true. In one, he told us repeatedly. I mean, you'd have to sit through it, but over and over again. And I went back to the prosecutors and I said, please just deny me. I want to end this case. And they said, no, you got to keep going. He made it sound like they were completely in control, which is not the way it works. They operate independently. And then in his deposition, it's, I believed. What I don't get is why they brought him over to talk to us. This story would have probably faded away, right? I mean, we had done it big. We did an editorial that said this guy should be gone. But bringing him over where he tells clear lies changes the game. He's got to go. How can Justin Bibbs stand by this guy now that he is so clearly lied? And it wasn't just us. He talked to a bunch of pastors. He's talked to city council members. He can't stay. You can't have a ranking guy in that department stay. The other thing is, Bradford Davey came over with him, and he's the chief of staff.
That's the chief of staff, right.
And we kept asking him, why didn't your background check turn up any of this? And man, he gave us gobbledygook and spun before he ultimately said, this is too low level a job to have that kind of a background check. Okay. You give him that. It's kind of weak, but give him that. But wouldn't you do that check before you bring him over? Wouldn't you read his deposition before you bring him over to lay this case out to us? He seemed so sincere, didn't he? I mean, you were there.
So hat in hand.
Yeah. And it's just made up. It was made up nonsense. I don't see how they can stand by him now. I doubt city council is going to remain quiet knowing now just how badly he has mischaracterized what happened.
Also, on top of that, which also is mentioned in Courtney's story, former safety director Kerry Howard, who, all right, you know, for what it's worth, he resigned recently over an issue dealing with his own conduct. But he told Courtney Astolfi that he never would have approved of hiring McHugh had he known about this case. He said that he asked McHugh twice if there's anything in his past that he should be aware of, and McHugh said no. And it bears mentioning, too, that at the time of McHugh's deposition, he had also already been brought up on disciplinary charges for taking part in an unauthorized chase. That's another incident that you'd probably want to bring up when you're applying for a job, working for the police department in a city where constitutional policing and unauthorized chases have both been very big, sensitive topics here.
He's also the idea that he's too low level to merit a background check that would have included searching court records. I mean, wouldn't have been hard to find it. He's making $124,000 a year.
$124,000,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's not a low level job in the city of Cleveland. That's a high level job. So we'll see where this goes, but we're probably going to have to do another editorial. This is stunning. You can't have ranking public safety director who is telling lies.
This case was not a secret to the administration, but not at all. I mean, Justin Bibb knew about it as it was happening. They were friends, and McHugh told us that he confided in Justin Bibb at that time when it was happening. So they're, you know, the background search, they would have had to just look at what he actually said during the case. That's the missing piece of the puzzle here.
But Davey did say that this was not a hire in the mayor's administration. It was purely public safety. So what the mayor knew wouldn't have translated. You would think, though, that if you're hiring the mayor's roommate, it'd be radioactive and you would dot every I and cross every T and make sure you're completely invulnerable. Because guess what? People are going to question when you hire your college roommate. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Northeast Ohio does not have a lot of women leaders, and it is losing one who has been prominent for a decade. Laura, which critically important agency is about to go through a transition at the top?
This is Sandra Miller, who has served as president and CEO of the Cleveland Rape Crisis Center for more than a decade, and she's going to leave at the end of May to pursue other opportunities, which is basically like saying, yeah, peace out. At least she's not saying she's going to focus on her family. So she joined the organization as a director of education, outreach, and community partnerships in 2009. She was appointed president and CEO in 2013. And she's helped more than 100,000 people during her tenure. The revenue from the group grew sevenfold, now comes from all sorts of diverse sources and state, national levels, as well as philanthropic partners. And one of the largest independent rape crisis centers in the nation. It's considered a model. Now, We know that there's been some turmoil over there. The staff last month voted overwhelmingly in support of forming a union. So they're working with the Service Employees International Union at this point. I don't know exactly what's going on with the organization, but obviously there's some upheaval.
Yeah, clearly the overwhelming union vote says something about unhappiness there. But she has been a distinguished Cleveland leader for quite some time, and she's done a lot of good for this town.
Yeah, and it's a really important organization when you think about how many people she's helped and the changing laws and everything, that this has been a steady force for this town. So I hope that they're able to work out whatever issues there are so this can be a leading organization.
Layla, way back when you were a reporter in your early 30s, can you remember back that far? You did a big rape kit project. You dealt with her in that project.
Yes, we did. Yeah. Yes, we did. She's a terrific person, and I wish her the best.
All right. You're listening to Today in Ohio. The Cleveland International Film Festival also is in transition from its female leader. Lisa, who's the replacement there?
Well, it'll be another woman. Her name is Hermione Malone. She will be the new Cleveland International Film Festival executive director starting on June 10th. She's replacing Marcy Goodman, who is executive director of CIFF for nearly 25 years. Malone is a Detroit native. She got her MBA from Case Western Reserve's Weatherhead School of Management. She's served on several boards and committees. She's had leadership roles at Cleveland Clinic and University Hospitals. Malone, in a statement, says she's thrilled to return to the city and lead CIFF at a transformative time, and she wants to help reimagine ways to attract new audiences and deepen community partnerships. And during her time, she comes to us from the American Journalism Project. She was head of emerging markets there. And during her time, she launched a nonprofit, Free Press Indiana, and raised $17 million in seed funding for that group.
This also comes as the Cinematheque is going through a leadership change. So two key film leaders in Cleveland. It'd be interesting to see how that scene changes with new perspective. You're listening to Today in Ohio. A year ago, we were coming into a period of intense smoke from Canadian wildfires that on some days made it look like Mars around here. Can we expect a repeat this year, Laura?
No, thank goodness. And that's because our wildfires last year, basically the smoke came from Quebec, and things are looking a whole lot better there. It hasn't been nearly as dry. And for that to even happen, even if there are a lot of wildfires, the wind has to be in a north-south direction, which created this river of smoke that kept pummeling Ohio and further south. And that's not normal. So Quebec and Ontario have had normal amounts of rains this past month. That's great for the fire season. But this is really funny because I had this conversation in a hot tub in Vegas with two couples from Vancouver, and we started talking about wildfire season. And they said it's going to be really bad out there because they've had a drought and they've already had restrictions in place. So I'm glad to know, I'm sorry for them, but that the wind is not going to bring that smoke all the way here.
Yeah, it was so bad last year. I mean, how many mornings, Lisa, did you get up before the podcast and say, can you smell the smoke? Can you smell the smoke?
Right, and that weird orange looking sun.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It was so bad. It was the only time in my life I can remember they canceled youth sports for smoke. Right. And that was dangerous. No one was supposed to work out outside for at least one day. And for sensitive groups, it was for many multiple days. And I think we took it all for granted that summer is this lovely season where you could be outside all the time. And you realize the environment has a huge role on your health and you can't take it for granted.
Good reporting by Pete Cross. Check it out. It's on Cleveland.com. And you're listening to Today in Ohio. How is Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibb's team justifying no longer providing complete police reports to city council members, breaking with decades of practice, Layla?
At the heart of this story is Marcy's Law. It's a relatively new law that seeks to protect victims of crime. And starting last summer, the Cleveland police reports that council members receive no longer include the names of crime victims. The city law director, Mark Griffin, told council members last week that that's because provisions of Marcy's Law requires them to be redacted, But council members believe that Griffin is misinterpreting the law. So there's been kind of an ongoing flap about this. Council members argue that having access to the names of victims helps them monitor who's involved in incidents that prompt a police response, including victims. Council members say they can connect those victims to services. They can keep tabs on neighborhood crime trends and retaliation threats and improve public safety and conduct better oversight. But Griffin says that under Marcy's law, council members, like members of the public and members of the media, are no longer entitled to crime victim names. The law says that any public office or public official that's charged with the responsibility of knowing the name, address, or other identifying information of a victim or victim's representative as part of the office's or official's duties is entitled to the names of crime victims. And the law also specifies that unredacted names can be shared among public offices or public officials. And council members are saying that means them. But Griffin says, you know, that, well, then where do you draw the line? Some part-time city employee could argue that they also are entitled to know a rape victim's name, for example. And Griffin told council members that other big cities in Ohio are interpreting the law the same way that he is, and their city council members aren't getting those unredacted reports. They still haven't resolved this issue between city council and the administration.
Yeah, this is transparency. This is a bunch of mayoral administration saying, oh, good, we can shield things and make it harder for people to see when bad things happen. Of course, city council members deserve these unredacted. In this town, city council members are the front office, really, for City Hall. When people are having problems, they don't go to City Hall. They go to their council members. They need to know everything that's going on with crime. They know who the residents are. And so if they see names on the report, it might trigger things. For the administration to be taking this tack is ridiculous. This will end up going to court and City Council will win. I just am surprised that they're being that ridiculous. And to say, well, where do you draw the line? Well, how about it at elected officials? You know, let's draw the line there at very least. If you're elected to an office in the city representing people, you ought to be able to see the crime reports. You're listening to Today in Ohio. That's it for Monday. We didn't get to everything. We'll get to some more tomorrow. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Layla. Thank you for listening to Today in Ohio.